Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Le Poitevin Group conference call. If at any time during this call you need assistance, please press star zero for the operator. I would now like to turn the conference over to David Le Poitevin. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Okay, welcome to the Le Poitevin Inverted Yield Curve conference call. I have with me Fletcher, Mark, Darcy, portfolio managers, and research real estate income interest rate expert Aaron Hoffman. So I thought it was important because, again, lots of questions and some quite interesting things that have happened in the last couple of weeks. You know, last time I was on a call was the market was melting down. I was pretty adamant that this was nothing other than a correction similar to 1997. We've also seen corrections of this of similar magnitude. The correction in the S&P 500 was 19.8% peak to trough. And we saw a similar correction in 2011 and 2015, both of which were not times to be bailing on stocks. So I was pretty adamant that we were pretty close to a bottom because it wasn't there was no evidence of credit spreads widening or no evidence of recession indicators. That was just one of those times where stocks go down. Both, you know, all of us portfolio managers were on the phone from homes. Mark was in the office, but some of us were from homes on the phone with our clients, talking them off ledges on the 24th of December, which marked the bottom. And literally, well, you'd ask the clients, why do you want to sell? Because it's dropping. And that's not a good reason to sell. In fact, that's a good reason to buy. So thanks for those people that called in to at least listen to us because, again, there were some pretty powerful, no, I just want to sell. So that would have been a very expensive mistake. Okay, so long-term clients that have been clients of mine have seen three recessions and as long-term clients know, we've been pretty good at getting all three out of three, touch wood. So clients will also know that I've been pretty adamant that in this cycle, I said we couldn't have a recession because the yield curve wasn't inverted. So let me just explain what a yield curve is again. If you drew a graph, so put on your the old university days, if you drew a graph, and on the vertical axis, you have interest rates, and on the horizontal axis, you have the term of the interest rates. There's no such thing as an interest rate. You say, well, what's the interest rate for one day? What's the interest rate for 1 year? What's the interest rate for 5 years? And there's a borrowing interest rate, and then there's a savings interest rate. And everything is priced off the bond market. So what's the one-year bond? Now, the Bank of Canada or the U.S. Federal Reserve, they set the one-day rate. The bond market sets the expectations off of the interest rates, and that's what prices in a two-year bond or a three-year bond or a five-year bond. So what the chart looks like is pricing in the 0 1-day rate, the 30-day rate, the 90-day rate, the 1 year, the 2 year, the 3 year, up to 10 years. And that gives you a curve. And the normal curve goes from the bottom left to the upper right in a sloping left to right upwards fashion. And that's called a normal yield curve. 3% of the time, the curve is inverted, which means that you get a higher interest rate for 1 day than you would 2 or 3 years. And that's called a yield curve inversion. Now, clients will know that every single recession in U.S. history is preceded by an inverted yield curve. And why we had a lot of calls a couple of weeks ago was on a Thursday of a week and a week and a half ago, the yield curve in the United States inverted. So let's make a distinction here. What does that mean? Every recession in U.S. history is preceded by an inverted yield curve, but not every inverted yield curve leads to recession. Most do. So let's look at what's going on here. So if somebody was buying the Bank of Canada overnight rate, so a bank can deposit multiple amounts of money, $1 billion, at the Bank of Canada for one day at 1.75%. And yet the 5-year went to 1.39. In the United States, we had a range of 2.25 to 2.5, so T-bills were rating around 2.33 in the United States, a 30-day T-bill, and interest rates fell to about 2.18 to invert the curve. Okay? Now, when you talk about inverted yield curves, you cannot look at it on a one-day basis. You got to look at it. It has to be around for more than one day. So anyone buying a midterm bond at a yield below the T-bill rate is doing so under the assumption that rates are set to fall. Now, rates historically fall in recessions. So the bond market has been quite accurate in saying, things have slowed. So let's look at who are the buyers of the bonds that price in expectations. First buyer are institutions, banks, pension funds. Individuals will go out and buy government bonds, a lot less so than institutions. But in this cycle, we have two new entrants, which are not nearly as prevalent in previous cycles. Number one is foreign buyers. And the interesting thing is that the two most important currencies in the world are the U.S. dollar and the euro. Germany, as Europe's been slowing in the late part of 2018, and again, some possible banking scenarios, European rates have gone back into negative territory. So that means you have to pay for the privilege of owning a 2-year German Bund that is denominated in euros. And that's the only risk-free currency, totally risk-free. So that becomes the benchmark interest rate of the euro currency. The U.S., which was yielding 2.5, became a high-yield currency. So if you didn't want to pay to have your money sitting in euros, you could buy U.S. dollars, and there wasn't really this yield curve. They were just buying them because the yield spread was tremendous. The other interesting part, and we've never seen this in any other cycles, is the presence of exchange-traded funds called ETFs. And what I've found, and I call these zombie portfolios, what I have found is when I see accounts coming in from RBC and TD and National Bank, these banks now have a cookie-cutter predetermined asset allocation based on where you put your check marks and your investment objectives and how old you are. And so if you're 65 years old, they're going to tell you you must have 65% in bonds. Well, the yield on the 5-year bond in Canada hit 1.32%. The biggest inflow the week before last was into a Bank of Montreal ETF with a 0.56% management fee, and your broker probably also charges you a 1% fee. So they're sitting there at 40 with a 1.56% fee on their bond portfolio yielding 1.32. I don't know. My math just doesn't work on that, but I'll give you some numbers which are quite shocking. If we look at the fund flows from, I don't have last week, but from the week before, and that was the week that the stock market was down when the yield curve began to invert. There was $398 million for the week in Canada that went into the top 10 exchange-traded funds. Of that money that was going in, 64.2% of that was going into bond ETFs, despite the fact that they were going to yield more than their yield less than their management fees. In the same week, if we look at the top 10 outflows, it was $605 million of outflows of stocks, and 97.6% was out of equity funds, and only 2.4% was out of bond ETFs. So the investing public has become entrenched with bonds as a way of hedging against recession. I'm going to go through a bit of history here and talk about where interest rates have gone in previous recessions. If we go look back at 2007, the 10-year Government of Canada benchmark bond yield was 4.62% in January of 2007. My long-term clients will remember that we bought a whole bunch of Government of Canada real return bonds at 3% plus inflation. We owned a whole bunch of BC bonds, Ontario bonds at about a 5.5% yield. So we went a little smidge of risk over the benchmark Government of Canada, and that worked out very well. What's really interesting is then bond yields in the recession fell to 3.13%. So that was January of 2009. You're in the throes of banks failing, credit blowing up. That was near as ugly as it got. The market would bottom 2 months later. And if you had bought a 10-year bond for those two-year periods, your compounded rate of return, because the price went up about 12%, would have been about 11% per annum to own that bond. What's interesting is, as I mentioned, the bottom of the yields in 2009 were 3.13. With all this ETF buying, the 10-year bond today is up where it was 7 trading days ago when the yield curve inverted, but it's 1.70%. So, which is down from October of 2018 of 2.48. So bond yields are almost half of what they were in the throes of the recession. So it might be that the bond market has overplayed this fear of the economy. I'm going to go through inverted curves and some of the differences. Since the invention of the automobile, so if we go back to 1900, we look at every recession, there have been in order for a yield curve to invert, it has to go flat. But that's just the nature of math. If something's tipped left to right to an upslope, before it goes the other way, it's a teeter-totter. It's gotta go flat at some point. The teeter-totter's got to flatten before it inverts. And I'm going to call last week flat because as of today, the yield curve inversion in the United States has ended. So we had five because it ended a couple of days ago. We had 5 trading days of yield curve inversion. I would say quite adamantly that you cannot have 1 or 2 trading days of yield curve inversion to get a recession. The most probable outcome is you need to have a minimum of 1 quarter of yield curve inversion. Now, let's remember in 2006, when the yield curve inverted, the U.S. Federal Reserve raised rates another 4 times to not only keep the yield curve inversion for over a year, but to take a wound and stick another knife in it. Now we've got a flesh wound, but the Fed has said, you know what, we're going to let that thing heal. We're not going to stick a knife in it, and that's one of the reasons the market's gone up. So since the invention of the automobile, you need a few things. You need the inverted curve to be around for more than a few days. The other thing you need is a spike in oil. You need a spike in inflation and inflation expectation, and you need a rise in interest rates. So I'm going to contrast 2007 to today. The price-earnings ratio of the stock market in 2007 was a little over 20 times earnings in 2007. Today, it's 16.5. Oil in 2007 was $140 a barrel. Today it's 61. You need in order to go into recession, you need evidence that credit is deteriorating. Now, let's remember 2007, I wrote a piece called Credit Crunch, wrote that Lapointeven letter, I called it Credit Crunch, and I pointed out that subprime spreads were blowing up and beginning to deteriorate. And today, there is no evidence of any kind of credit deterioration. In 2007, U.S. had $1.33 of debt at the household level for a dollar of income. Today, it's $1 of debt for a dollar of income. So the risk of a recession today has gone, a couple of years ago, it was almost zero. Today, the recession risk is not zero. But at the end of the day, it's highly, highly unlikely that the United States will have a 2009 scenario in it. You know, when the yield curve inversion and when the Dow was down, I forget what it was for the day, it was 450, I think, points, and there was a little panic in the air. General Mills, Southern Company, Verizon were all hitting new 52-week and multiple-year highs. And these are stocks that are kind of blue chip, Cheerios, your wireless bill, your electric utility company. We're at new highs because, as David Rosenberg points out at Gluskin Sheff, it's not a foregone conclusion that if the U.S. tips to zero or a slightly negative number, that everyone's going to run for the sidelines because the alternative is so terrible. Let's remember, as I just mentioned, we were buying bonds north of 5% in 2007. Today, bond yields at 1.7 or 2.25 in the United States look very, very unappealing on a relative basis. So, at this point, I would say that the best course of action is to probably continue holding good quality blue chip, not highly cyclical stocks. Now, there's an important distinction here because a lot of people look at their portfolios and they feel a little bit uncomfortable with the higher allocation to equities. Look at the quality of the equities. As we predicted, the S&P 500 is coming off a very terrible quarter with a bit of a V, and it's got its best quarter since 1998. And again, I pointed out that the most likely scenario was that last quarter's correction was very similar to the 1997 Thai baht crisis, where Asia went into a sharp turndown. And I said that the Asian turndown didn't affect the U.S., nor is this current Asian turndown as likely. But the interesting thing is the market bounced back in 98 very, very strongly, and the market bounced back very close to that 1998 bounce back. So, in sum, probably the best course of action is to collect our coupons, collect our dividends. We've been very good at looking at the major trend and where fund flows are. And because, and I've used this cliche, the wife goes, says, we're going out for dinner, I got nothing clean, the cleanest dirty shirt in the laundry. There's going to be a shirt. Capital has to find a home. And all the people that call say, I want to go to cash. As soon as, the dust settles a little bit, nobody wants to stay in cash because it's extremely unappealing. As I said, in 2007, if you wanted to go to cash, the yields were very, very high relative to today. So, that's where we are. We see lots of opportunities, lots of up stocks that are very, very well priced. So at the end of the day, that's what we're doing, and that seems to have proven correct. I've had a number of questions, mostly about yield curves, which I think I've answered. I did have an interesting question. As you know, we love to invest for income. As you know, we've been touting preferred stock. And one of the clients sent in a bunch of money and liked the idea from the last conference call and is very happy with the preferreds. But he called in and he said, if the Bank of Canada is going to cut rates, wouldn't it be better to switch from floating rate to fixed rate? Now, that's an excellent, very astute question. Now, the floating rates, it's an interesting year, because if we look at Great West Life preferred stock, which were fixed, and you could have bought them on January the 1st at about a 5.5% yield. The yield's fallen to about 5.28 or 2.9 on Great West Life, very high credit quality, which is up about 7% plus your dividends on the year. So people are looking at the possibility of a rate cut, and they're saying, wow, fixed at a 5-plus yield is pretty attractive, and those preferreds have been going up. Bell Canada preferreds are down 10%, and those are the ones that are linked to prime, so people are worried that prime is going to go down. So excellent question. Are those going to continue to fall? Well, Great West Life today yields 5.28, and Bell Canada yields 6.42. So the market has already factored in between 3 and 4 rate cuts. Now, the bond market is factoring in the next 5 years, 1 rate cut. So we have to say, no, the preferred market is correct. There's going to be 4 rate cuts. Let's go to fixed. Whereas the bond market is telling us there's going to be only 1 rate cut. Avery Schoenfeld of CIBC, chief economist, thinks there will be no rate cuts and thinks the next move will continue to be higher. I personally don't see that, but I see a Bell Canada preferred where you're earning 6.4%, and if there's a rate cut, you're still earning 6. The preferred index, I say just be patient. Preferred index is up about 0.5% for the year, plus your yield. Now, your yield is over 5.5 on the combination. So for a quarter, even if it's 0, we're trouncing the return of GICs. We had a client send in, and it was a separate account, so we know, sent in a large chunk of money, liked the idea of preferred stock, sent in a million bucks, seeing who it is, and it's up 3.5%. And, there's nothing wrong with that on a quarter. I'd be surprised if they're not up 10. But just be patient. We are getting – the yield spreads are tremendous. I think both fixed and what they call fixed floating are going to do very well. But let's not all chase high returns. I'm going to make one other point, and that is because the risk of a recession is not zero anymore, I'm talking about a U.S. recession – We need to continue with a high quality. Now, when the market is having a fantastic quarter like the S&P, which is up, 12% or something, if you're in low beta, high quality income earning stocks, they're not going to move with the market. The market is moving, again, higher risk stocks higher up. Now, if somebody's interested in that and they want to change the risk profile of the account, I'd rather have a higher allocation to equities but a lower risk structure within equities. It's also interesting to point out that the average stock is lagging badly. Well, the S&P is now about 2 to 3% away from an all-time high from erasing the gains which it met in October of last year. The Value Line Composite Index, which measures all stocks in the United States, all stocks, is more than 10% away from where it was last October, and the Russell 2000 is almost 15% down from where it was in October, which is 2,000 stocks from the 501st largest company to the 2,500th biggest company. So patience, income. We've seen this movie before. I would say stay the course, and if somebody feels that they need to review, we're happy to do that. I will point out one thing that clients have asked about as well. Is there a difference between the yield curve in Canada and the United States? And the answer is a big yes, and that is – The data in Canada is beginning to weaken much more rapidly than the United States. And we've talked about, I mentioned that the United States at the peak was $1.33 of debt for a dollar of household income. Canada has blown through that, where Canada was in better shape in 2009. We have gone on a spending and real estate and renovation and car spending binge. And there's $1.74 of debt, and it is beginning to weigh. The real estate market in Vancouver is becoming unglued. Aaron, what were the numbers today? We were down from March was very weak of last year, and we were down 31% of a already weak. We have the lowest March numbers since what?
1986.
Since 1986 of real estate, and that's not population. That's just hard numbers. The market is becoming very, very weakly bid. The stuff that's selling is selling continually. Comparables are going down and down. So that's going to affect consumer spending, and the data is going to continue to get weak. Now, I'm not going to make a prediction on the Canadian dollar because when it was 77 or 78, I said I thought it would have a home of 75. My issue is I think that oil still remains firmer and could potentially go up, and the Canadian dollar worldwide is still a petrol currency. I think at the end of the day, those two factors might bounce it around, but I would still feel much more comfortable in U.S. dollars versus Canadian dollars. I think in the long run, housing construction, the building permits and housing starts are really beginning to materially weaken, and housing starts equates to construction jobs in a few months. And so at the end of the day, the most important industry in Canada by a mile is weakening and going into its own mini recession. And therefore, by the fourth quarter of this year, the numbers in Canada are going to be quite a bit weaker in the United States, which likely means further devaluation of the Canadian dollar. But in the short run, could easily hit 77 cents under a rising oil. I don't know, but I don't want to have too many conversations about people's portfolios that are 75 or 70% U.S. dollars have a greater impact on a day-to-day basis from a currency than it does the stock. So, you know, if you're more comfortable in Canada, we don't like volatility, those are discussions we're happy to have with our clients. But that's where we are. I still feel optimistic that given today's environment, the most likely scenario is an U.S. slowdown, which has been factored in, but not a recession. It just wasn't in, a week is not a yield curve inversion. It's flat. And ironically, well, there's many examples in history of flat yield curves leading to several more years of robust stock market activity. And the fact that the Fed is on hold and we're still at a very, very low U.S. Fed funds of 2.25 to 2.5, and U.S. households are in relatively good shape, doesn't mean that we're going to have a recession. So I've spoken long enough. Can we open that up for questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, should you have a question, please press star followed by 1 on your touchtone phone. If you're using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before pressing any keys. One moment, please, for your first question. Your first question is from Christian. Christian, please go ahead.
Hi guys, thank you very much for the update. Great to hear how you guys are thinking about the economy. A couple of quick questions I have for you. I take it you guys have been watching U.S. economic data.
Yeah.
Growth is certainly slowing there. You brought that up just now. One thing that's definitely going to play out over the next couple of quarters here is there was a real sugar spike, obviously, last year in the U.S. economy with the U.S. tax cuts. And there's some really tough year-over-year comparisons that are coming up in the next two quarters. Any concerns about those comparisons having a potential challenges with earnings, having a compressing factor on market valuations or P/E ratios?
Oh, awesome question. You know, it's really counterintuitive. We had second quarter in the United States at 4.2. We had third quarter at 3.6, and stocks went down. Now we got slowing earnings. We've had the best quarter since 1998 of stocks. Again, it's alternatives. Year-over-year comparisons are going to be like, you know, last year we had earnings way up. It's really clear that the best scenario for stocks is a muddling through 1% to 2% growth. You get 4% growth, stocks historically do poorly. Its 1987 crash was 6% GDP growth. No recession, but a stock market crash. There's an old adage, Marty's wag, don't fight the Fed. The Fed was tightening last year, slow growth. If it looks to me like the bond market priced in a possible rate cut, but because credit spreads haven't widened, it looks like the Fed, U.S. Federal Reserve Board, is in this mindset that if economic data weakened, they would actually cut. And, you know, I'm not sure they want to cut, and I'm not sure the numbers are that weak. We've got the lowest unemployment rate since Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. So, you know, we'll see. The year-over-year comparisons were great a year ago, and the stock market was not good. Year-over-year comparisons, again, mean that the bond yields are dramatically low, which is very atypical this point in the cycle. You need to have a spike in rates to have a recession. Rates have been rolling down. So it just feels like, you know, in 19... Customs, let me just go to this. In 1996, before the Thai baht crisis led to the Asian flu, the 10-year Canada traded 776. The Fed went on hold as the world economy began to slow, and yields fell to 488 before jumping again in 2000. That slower economic growth led to another 3 years of fantastic stocks, 4 years. So we'll see, but I'm not particularly worried about year-over-year comparables, but good question.
Thank you. One other quick question. You talked about the U.S. household balance sheets looking really good. What about, have you guys looked at the corporate balance sheets and your thoughts on that? Because I hear that that's a potential real mess waiting to happen there.
There's corporate balance sheets are, I mean, people have been worried about it. They've been talking about it for a couple of years. It's almost predictable that as a corporation, you can borrow a 3 or 4%. Like, you know, Apple has $1 trillion of debt or some huge number, and yet they're also sitting on cash on their balance sheets, which is just kind of moving money around the world. For the solid companies, it makes sense to be borrowing because, you know, you're borrowing with a tax deduction at 3 to 4%. I'm not particularly worried about that. What does worry me, and again, this actually is stimulative to the economy in 2019, but, I mean, U.S. is going to run a deficit of almost 5% of GDP. If we want to worry about something in the long run, that's what I worry about. Ironically, again, the bigger the deficit, the better stocks do, which is completely counterintuitive because it stimulates the economy. But it's all a worry, which is also why I think that interest rates will stay below inflation. In other words, the real interest rate will have a negative return for as far as the eye can see. Because nobody wants to blow up anything. So we'll see.
Thank you.
Yep.
Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, should you have a question, please press star followed by one. Our next question is from Tom. Tom, please go ahead.
I was wondering what your thoughts are on international funds.
Like international mutual funds?
Or ETFs, or anything that has kind of like a global portfolio.
Well, we like it. Despite the negative headlines in Europe, valuations of European large cap companies are trading around 14 times earnings. Now that produced a lower return than the S&P last year, but the Europe is leading the S&P by quite a margin this year. We have a lot of Wisdom Tree Europe fund, and it's up 15% for the quarter. So Europe looks extremely appealing to me from a valuation perspective. And again, if they muddle muddle along, and the European Central Bank seems open to more quantitative easing and more flooding the money than international looks decent. The most comfortable is the United States, and they have the kind of companies we want to buy, but we definitely have been increasing European exposure. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, once again, if you do have a question, please press star followed by one. There are no further questions at this time. Please proceed.
Okay, thank you. That's it. Wrap it up.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the Potavin Group call for today. We thank you for your participation and have a great day.